Thank you. I am Robert Mack, M-A-C-K, registration number 017529, representing the city of Colorado Springs in this matter. I would like to reserve 10 minutes of my time for rebuttal argument.
Much, sir?
10 minutes.
10 minutes. Thank you.
Basically, this is a case that involves a matter which lies in tort or could lie in tort. The first group has alleged two claims, which are really one. The first claim is fraudulent inducement, for which they seek rescission of the contract. However, proving fraudulent inducement requires approving of damages. The damages they would have to prove in order to get that fraudulent inducement are the same damages that they would seek at this time to prove in what they claim is a contract claim. That is the amount paid to employees for retirement vacation benefits. Because they had pled the matter as a tort, it obviously could lie in tort. First group did specifically plead that the city made a promise. The city had no intent to keep that promise. Time was made. That promise, with no intent to keep it, fraudulently induced first group to enter into the contract, which resulted in First Transit then, in their argument, paying the funds out, which results in the damage, which must be proved again for the fraudulent inducement.
Go ahead. Mr. Mack, when you said that with fraudulent inducement you need damages, was this a complaint which filed a claim for fraudulent inducement requesting as relief damages?
Well, it's interesting, Your Honor. First group is attempting to argue that they should be allowed, because of the fraudulent inducement, to rescind the contract on the theory that the city might at some point sue First Transit for breach of contract, and then they could raise a fraudulent inducement defense. They did not specifically argue damages for the fraudulent inducement issue under the declaratory judgment. But under Colorado law, in order to get fraudulent inducement, which would then allow rescinding the contract, you have to prove the damages. So either they have failed to argue that, at which time they failed to state a claim for which relief can be granted, and therefore it should be dismissed, or they have impliedly stated it, and still they have to prove the damages, which is a tort matter, and so, again, it fails because the city is immune from an action under tort.
Simply because they have to prove damages to establish the fraudulent inducement, does that mean that they've established the portion of the CGIA that says shall be immune from liability when they're only seeking a declaratory judgment?
Well, I don't know that they've established anything at this particular point, but under the Governmental Immunity Act, if the matter lies in tort or could lie in tort, then the city is immune. And in fact, in order to prove the fraudulent inducement, and they do say in their answer brief, at page 23, they acknowledge it's a fraudulent inducement matter that they must prove in order to get the declaratory judgment.
Right, so, but I guess my question is that the CGIA provides that a public entity shall be immune from liability in all claims for injury which lie in tort or could lie in tort. And so by seeking a declaratory damage, how does that relate to that language, immune from liability?
Well, in order to get the declaratory judgment for a fraudulent inducement or fraudulent misrepresentation, they must prove the damages, okay? And if they prove the damages, then that is imposing liability on the city. Further, the fact that they may choose not to argue for damages, they could go in and say, well, we just want $1, we don't want anything else. So that doesn't negate the fact that under the law, it is a tort and the proof of the damages is required. So what we basically have here is a case where clearly the first group pled and two, basically by splitting a single claim that there was fraudulent inducement to enter into the contract which resulted in damages, they've split it so that they can attempt to receive rescission of the contract on a speculative matter, because it's pure speculation as to whether or not the city would ever sue First Transit on a contract that terminated in 2009 on any matter which would be related to the alleged fraud, which would allow the contract to be rescinded. And if the contract is rescinded, the court would allow the contract to be rescinded as a matter of fraudulent inducement or fraudulent misrepresentation, which is a tort, the choice in the Colorado law that is given is that First Group can elect to rescind the contract, or they can elect to affirm the contract and proceed for damages in tort. So either way that you look at it, the damages that they have tried to split out as a contract claim are in fact tort damages. If they were to get relief, say, or be allowed to a ruling that they could rescind the contract, they would first have to prove the damages in order to obtain that, and now you're back to proving tort damages. And I see that I'm into my 10th minute time, so are there any questions? Thank you. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time then.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Darren Nadell from the law firm Littler Mendelson. I represent First Group America, Inc. and First Transit, Inc., which have been referred to in the papers as First Transit. The Governmental Immunity Act, 24 CRS 2410-106-1, asks two questions, and if the answer to both of them is yes, then there's governmental immunity. The first question is, does the claim seek to impose liability on the defendant? The second question is, does it seek to impose liability for a claim that is either stated in tort or could have been stated in tort? To answer these questions, the court is to review the nature of the alleged injury and also the relief sought. The cases that stand for that proposition have been cited in the briefs. They're Adams versus Westminster, 140 P. 3rd at page 10, and Robinson versus Lottery Division, 179 P. 3rd at page 1003. There's a subtlety in the law here, which is that the court is not to focus on the relief sought purely to understand what the relief is to drive the claim, because the court has to analyze whether something could be stated in tort and whether there's another remedy. Instead, the reason the court looks at the relief sought is to inform itself of the nature of the injury and also the nature of the alleged duty imposed on the defendant that has been alleged to have been breached. If the duty is a contractual duty, there's no governmental immunity. If the duty is a duty imposed by law, then in general, it's a tort duty. It's a tort claim. Turning to that, the nature of the alleged injury for the breach of contract claim is a breach of a specific provision of a contract between the two parties, namely section 4.5S of a service contract between the City of Colorado Springs and First Transit. In general, that contract had First Transit provide bus service for the City of Colorado Springs and had the City of Colorado Springs pay First Transit for providing that bus service. Pursuant to that contract, First Transit employed all the employees who actually provide the service and maintained all the buses that run those routes.
Mr. Nadell, let me ask you this. How do your allegations of fraudulent inducement relate to that breach that you're claiming concerning the specific provision of the payment for built-up retirement and sick leave benefits?
They don't. It's true that the complaint incorporated by reference all the allegations that preceded each claim for relief. But the allegations of fraudulent inducement don't per se relate to the contract claim. They relate to the declaratory relief claim. And the declaratory relief claim says that the city made a promise, namely to reimburse First Transit for sick pay and vacation accrual that it ultimately then paid to the employees. It made a promise and had no intention of keeping that promise. And the law is also very clear that that's not a tort, nor could it be a tort. The Colorado Supreme Court has recognized that where the fraud or misrepresentation that's relied on is a failure to keep a promise or to do a future act, then that's not a tort, nor could it be a tort. Instead, a tort claim is only asserted when a party is accused of making a misrepresentation of facts.
Which case is that?
There are a few that stand for that proposition. The lead is probably the DeLozier case, and the other is Berg versus State Board of Agriculture.
Mr. Nadel, is the declaratory judgment claim dependent on proof of fraudulent inducement?
It's dependent on proof that that the city failed to keep a promise and that it had no intention of keeping that promise. So it's not dependent on proving that the city made a knowing misstatement of facts. It's dependent on the city on First Transit proving that the city made a promise and that it never intended to keep that promise at the time that it made that. And if I could turn specifically to the Byrd case, which discusses that very issue, in that case, the state agency had promised that in the future, it would maintain healthcare benefits at the same level that they existed at in the past, when it made a change from one health system to another. Relying on that promise, an individual went out and had a number of medical procedures, some transplants in particular, and the healthcare benefits didn't ultimately cover that claim, even though they would have in the past. The Byrd court said that is not a tort, nor could it be a tort, because the claim does not assert that that the government entity made a misrepresentation of facts. Instead, the government entity made a misrepresentation about whether it would honor, whether it would in the future pay a benefit at the same level that it paid them now. The Delosier case is also instructive on this issue. In the Delosier case, an individual was promised that he would be entitled to receive the next paramedic position that came up. Again, the government entity said, wait a second, that's a form of fraud, and therefore it's either a tort or could be a tort. The Delosier court disagreed and said, when the promise at issue is to perform a future event or refuse to perform a future event, that falls under the rubric of promissory estoppel, not the tort of misrepresentation.
Did the Delosier case involve a present intent not to perform, though? Isn't that what you're alleging here, and isn't that what makes it a little bit different from Delosier?
I do think that the Delosier case involved a present intent not to perform, that the promise that was alleged in the Delosier case was, you will get the next open paramedic position. And I believe the plaintiff alleged that there was no intention to keep that promise, and therefore that was the wrong that was complained of. And as the Supreme Court said in Delosier, whenever there is a present intent, whenever the claim is a present intent not to fulfill a future promise, or not to fulfill a promise that you're making in the future, that is not a tort in the state of Colorado, and that's found on page 716.
Mr. Nadel, let me ask you about that. In that case, weren't they seeking to enforce the promise? So, in effect, it was seeking to create a contract as a matter of law, and that's not the case here.
That is the case with our breach of contract claim. With respect to our declaratory relief claim, that's not what we're seeking. You're right. We're seeking, as a remedy, essentially the right to rescind the contract or to stop performing under the contract. And there are a couple cases that stand for the proposition that that remedy is a permissible remedy. And those are cited in the briefs. They're Camas versus Jeffco, Colorado Springs versus Connors.
I guess I'm getting confused. To the extent that you're relying on cases that involve promissory estoppel to bring this more into contract than tort, but here you're not seeking to enforce the promise, then why isn't it back into tort instead of out of tort through promissory estoppel?
Because rescission is not a tort remedy, nor could it be a tort remedy.
But didn't you just say that it didn't really matter what the remedy sought was? It was the nature of the injury?
No, and thank you for allowing me to clarify that. I said that there is language in some of the cases which says you cannot rely solely on the nature of the relief sought to determine whether the claim is in tort or could be in tort. But nevertheless, the relief sought does inform the court about the type of the duty that has been breached and whether is it a duty imposed by contract or by tort law. That's specifically from the Robinson case. So that said, the court still does analyze the nature of the relief sought. And the nature of the relief sought here is essentially the right to stop performing under the contract. And that is not barred by the Colorado Government Immunity Act for two reasons. The first is, it doesn't seek to impose liability on the city for anything, which is the first question that must be answered in the affirmative in order for there to be governmental immunity. Instead, the claim seeks to allow First Transit to stop performing under the contract without itself becoming liable for any wrong. And because of that, you never even need to get to the question for the declaratory relief claim of whether it is a tort or could be a tort claim, because you never get past the does it seek to impose liability prong. The answer is no, it doesn't seek to impose liability. It seeks a declaration that if First Transit stops performing under the contract, it will not be liable for anything. And that's why, as we've said in our briefs, it's asserted in a defensive posture.
In that regard, let me ask you this, Mr. Nadel. If I understand Mr. Mack's argument correctly, he's arguing that because your declaratory judgment request is based on an alleged fraudulent inducement, in order to prove your claim, you're going to have to prove damages in order to succeed, and that somehow is going to result in the imposition or potential imposition of liability on the city. How do you respond to that argument?
And thanks for letting me address that directly. To begin with, again, because of the way the claim is stated, the complaint itself makes very clear we're not seeking to impose any liability on the city for anything. So you never really get to that. You never really need to get to the question of whether damages might or might not be available under the claim. But for the sake of argument, to analyze the is it a tort or could it lie in tort because of the type of remedy it seeks, the remedy of rescission is not a tort remedy, nor could it be. And we've cited cases for that proposition, and I've just listed them. Perhaps more importantly, I've just lost my train of thought. The wrong for which First Transit is seeking relief, namely the ability to stop performing under the contract, is a wrong that is rooted in contract law. The duty that arises is a duty that arises out of the promissory estoppel doctrine, which is in the body of contract law. That's why the Delosier case is such an important case, and that's why the Byrd case are such important cases, because the remedy that we seek flows from the duty imposed by the body of promissory estoppel law. Namely, the body of promissory estoppel law says you cannot make a promise without the present intent to perform that promise later. That's the root of the declaratory relief claim, and the remedy that we seek flows only from that claim. If instead we had said, at the time the city signed the contract, they said we were only going to have to pay sick pay benefits to 87 employees, when in fact they knew there were 132 employees. That would be a claim that would be barred by the Colorado Government Immunity Act. The reason is because that would have been a misrepresentation of fact by the city. Namely, the city would have said there's a certain number of employees that are covered, when in fact there are a whole lot more. The duty to be honest about facts is a duty that is embedded and arises from tort law. The duty to keep a promise and to have an intent to keep your promise at the time you make it is a duty that arises out of the doctrine of promissory estoppel, which, as the Supreme Court has said in the Delosier case and also the court has said in the Byrd case, arise under the doctrine of promissory estoppel and cannot state a claim for misrepresentation in the state of Colorado.
Mr. Nadel, do you disagree then that you would have to prove damages first in order to get to the entitlement of rescission?
I absolutely disagree with that. I think all we need to prove is that the city made a promise, it had no intention of keeping that promise, and then it didn't keep the promise, and therefore we no longer have to perform the contract. We can now stop. We no longer have to honor the obligations that are lasting in the service contract that are imposing, that we must live up to today. So said in other ways, we've said in our papers, another option First Transit had, but is an option the declaratory relief statute is designed to forgive you from having to take, is we could have just stopped performing under the contract. We could have said, you know what, you've breached, now we're gonna stop performing. We could have then waited to be sued and then found out the hard way whether we were right or wrong. The declaratory judgment statute allows you to ask the question first of the court, am I correct in my legal analysis that their conduct has excused our performance? And if it has, I'm going to wait to stop my performance until the point you tell me it's okay, because I don't want to go through a trial. I don't want to have a suit against me for damages. I don't want to take the risk first and find out the answer later. With that, I'm finished unless you have other questions.
it's not.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Mack, you have about 9.5 minutes.
Thank you. The first problem with the issue of the Lozier case, the Bird case, those were cases involving promissory estoppel, essentially. In those cases, there's no allegation that the government had made any sort of promise that it had no intent to keep at the time the promise was made. Rather, those were promises that were made, which for various circumstances were not carried out later on. But more importantly, in Colorado, promissory estoppel is a doctrine that applies where you don't actually have a valid contract. So whether you're looking more of an equitable nature of promissory estoppel, well, you made this promise, so we're going to hold you to it. In this case, there is a valid contract. First Transit, First Group admits that it's a valid contract. They plead that in their complaint. They say there's a valid and binding contract. So promissory estoppel doctrine doesn't even apply in this case. Further, as First Group has stated, what they have to show for their fraudulent inducement rescission matter is that the city made a promise, the city had no present intent to keep that promise, that they were induced to enter into the contract by that promise, and that when the city then did not carry out the promise, there were damages in tort. That's what they have to prove for a fraudulent inducement.
Can you address the could have stopped performing argument?
Could have stopped performing?
Right. The city alternatively could have just stopped performing and then asserted this as a defense.
I believe First Group has argued that they could have simply stopped performing the contract and then asserted promissory estoppel as a defense. I don't believe that's correct. There's nothing that I'm aware of in Colorado law, the promissory estoppel doctrine or in the fraudulent inducement doctrine that allows a party with unclean hands to come forward then and raise a fraudulent inducement defense, especially in this case where apparently they're arguing that the very damages that they supposedly suffered rise out of this alleged promise that was for which there was no intent to be kept. So no, I would say that this is not a matter where it can be raised as defense. What they're doing is they're raising it as an offense. They have not made the election after they argued that this is a matter of fraudulent misrepresentation or fraudulent inducement. They have not made the election that's required in Colorado law as to whether or not they wish to proceed with rescission, for which then we would have a trial on rescission, I suppose, or keep the contract in place and proceed for damages in tort. But the key is that they have pled, and you do look at the pleadings, and you look at the pleadings in the best light of what the plaintiff has argued. If you look at those pleadings and you say, okay, what are they really saying here? What is the real nature of the case? The real nature of the case that you have here is that they are arguing that they were harmed because the city made a promise that induced them to enter the contract. No matter how they split that, whether they split the 2 claims, 3 claims, 4 claims, overall, when you look at it, that's what they're saying. And nor is the court bound to take each claim and keep it as a separate and insular action. You can look at, overall, what is it that they're trying to do here? What are they arguing here? And quite clearly from their argument and their briefs, they are looking at, well, the city defrauded us. They lured us into this contract. Then we went and paid these employees. And then the city refused to pay. Okay? That breach of that section of the contract that they argue is contract breach is directly and intimately related to the alleged promise that was made with no intention of keeping it. Okay, if you look at the pleadings, you see that in part of the language that they incorporate into each of their claims, they're talking about how the city and the RFP process took this matter out of the RFP, how the city promised that they were going to pay this money, and then you got down to the contract, and the city didn't have any intention of doing that, and that's how they get damaged.
They plead specifically the intention not to perform as far as the contract claim, or is that there just by, let's say, inartful pleading of referring back to the facts?
No, that's actually in the complaint. They actually said that the city has no intent of carrying out the promise.
Is that pled in complaint with the first claim, or was it specifically pled in complaint with the second claim?
Well, they split their their paragraphs of their complaint in 3 sections. First, they had a lead-up section which they put all the history of what the city had allegedly done wrong and how the city had made the allegations or the offer or however you want to describe it in the RFP process. Then they took their first claim for relief, which conveniently is their declaratory judgment claim, and in that they state the elements that the city made the promise that the city had no intent of carrying it out. Okay, they do that by incorporating the first section into the second section. Then when they go to the alleged contract claim, they incorporate all the claims that they have made, all the allegations they've made under the declaratory judgment claim, except the last paragraph, which indicates that the incorporation is in fact intentional, because they did take out the last paragraph of the first claim for inducement. They took that out. That was the claim for relief. They incorporated all those other claims and all that other information into the so-called contract claim. So it's clearly pled, no matter how you want to dice it or slice it, it's clearly pled as a promissory situation where the city made a promise it had no intention of carrying out that induced them into the contract.
So you're saying if they hadn't pled it in this fashion, if they had just had a third claim saying the city made this contract to pay the benefits and didn't do it without any allegations of any sort of intent or fraudulent inducement, that that would be a valid contract claim that would survive?
Well, I think that you have to look at what is actually pled at the time that you're looking at whether or not Governmental Immunity Act applies.
All right, and I'm asking if it was pled differently.
If they had simply come in and pled that the city has a contract that has this paragraph in it, and that the city breached that paragraph, then I suppose you would argue that that they are pleading a contract claim. There's no indication in the pleadings at that point that they are in any way raising fraudulent inducement, nor would there then be a declaratory judgment issue, because there'd be no rescission for a promise in that case, because it would not have pled the issues. But the problem is that we know what their issue is. We know that they believe that they were defrauded because they pled it. And we have to go forward and determine whether or not this matter is subject to the Governmental Immunity Act based on what they have pled, not what they might have pled had they thought about this and decided, well, we need to avoid this tort issue, so let's just plead this in contract. Or had they decided to try to plead in some other matter? And the fact of the matter is that where you have a promise allegedly made, for which there is no intent to keep that promise, that is a tort. And the Governmental Immunity Act is not just tied to two questions of whether or not there's liability or whether it states a claim that might impose liability. In reestablishing the sovereign immunity, what the legislature said, and this had to be clarified because of decisions in the court, is that the government is immune from any and all actions that sound in tort, that lie in tort, or could lie in tort. This is an action that could lie in tort. It is therefore barred by the Governmental Immunity Act. It's as simple as that. And no matter how you look at the pleadings, this is what First Transit pled. They pled a tort. The duty is not to make a promise when you have no present intent of carrying it out. That's a separate duty from any duty in the contract. But there's nothing that says that once that promise, if you will, which you have no intention of carrying out, is reduced to a clause in the contract, then that automatically removes any tort allegations or issues. That's simply then when the promise isn't carried out, then you simply look and you say, well, they made the promise. They didn't intend to carry it out. They induced us into the contract, then they didn't perform. Well, of course they didn't perform. If they made the promise with no intent to perform, then they don't perform. That's not a contract matter. That's a tort matter.
Does it make a difference that the relief requested was rescission of the contract?
It does not in this case, because what they pled is rescission in tort. When you plead, when you're going to raise an issue of rescission of the contract based on the fraudulent action of the other party, you must prove in trial for the rescission that in fact the fraud occurred. And part of the element for proving the fraud is proving the damages. And the damages in this case are exactly what First Transit argues they are, the failure of the city to pay money that First Transit paid out under, by the way, a collective bargaining agreement to which the city was not a party. So the promise under which they paid their employees has nothing to do with the city. So, no, in this case, you clearly have a situation which either is a tort or could sound in tort, could lie in tort, and it's barred by the Governmental Immunity Act. Are there any other questions I can answer? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mack. And thank you also, Mr. Nadel, both of you, for your excellent arguments. Those will be helpful to the division. And this matter will stand submitted, and an opinion will be issued in due course.